We come to it now, the very center of it all. Paul said, I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus, Messiah, Jesus Christ, and Him crucified. Truly the very, very center of the gospel, right? The gospel is a wide message of the kingdom of God, but the very center of the gospel, the beating heart of the gospel, is the proclamation of a crucified king. And that's where we'll center our gaze. The night before His death, Jesus came together with His disciples to eat Passover. Passover was this special meal for the Jewish people, where they remembered and reflected on their origin story, right? Their very beginnings as God rescued them from Egyptian slavery. You think about the powerful miracles, the plagues that God performed in showing who He was, showing Himself, His name, making His name known to the Egyptians, and declaring judgment on Pharaoh and on the Egyptian gods. And so what the people of Israel would do on this Passover is they would gather as families, and they would remember that act of and that story that was at the epicenter of their identity, that judgment that God brought, the way He passed through the midst of Egypt, striking every firstborn down, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, to the firstborn of the slave girl, to the firstborn of all cattle as well, and how God didn't pass through Israel, but how God passed over Israel when He saw the blood of the Lamb on the doorpost. And this dual act of judgment and salvation, where God rescued and redeemed Israel from slavery, and He becomes their king. Again, what is it? What is that final great declaration at the end of Exodus 15, that song of Moses as they've come through the Red Sea, Yahweh, our King. And then God brought them through the wilderness to Mount Sinai, where He called them as His own special peoples. We've talked about this week, in a kingdom of priests, a holy nation, where He gave them the law, where He entered into covenant with them. And it's this story of Passover, of judgment, of salvation, of rescue and redemption and kingdom, that's framing this last Passover meal that Jesus would share with His disciples, and is going to frame the events that would follow in the next few hours. At the end of this meal, in keeping with the Jewish traditions of the time, Jesus and His disciples sang a hymn, very likely the last of the Hallel Psalms, Psalm 115 through 118, as we understand would have been probably a tradition at this time. After singing a hymn, Jesus went up on the Mount of Olives just east of Jerusalem, and He told His disciples, "You will all fall away because of Me this night, because it's written, 'Strike down the shepherd and the sheep of the flock scatter, but after I've been raised, I'll go ahead of you to Galilee.'" But His disciples wouldn't hear Him. They would not that just they couldn't, they wouldn't hear Him. They all reconfirmed their allegiance to Him, denying that we would ever deny Him, pledging even to die before they deny Him. And then Jesus came to the place called Gethsemane, and He commanded His disciples to pray. And Jesus took three of His disciples, Peter, James, and John, and told them, "Keep praying." He said, "My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch with Me." And He went a little beyond them, and He fell on His face, and He prayed, "My Father, if possible, let this cup pass from Me." I just cannot do that text justice. But if you can think with me and imagine with me as He falls on His face and says, "My Father, if possible, let this cup pass from Me, yet not as I will, but as You will." And then He returns to His disciples, and He found them sleeping. And you just think of that gut punch as they're asleep. Could You not keep watch with Me for 1 hour? And where do you put the emphasis when you read that? Could You not keep watch with Me for 1 hour? Keep watching and praying that You may not enter into temptation. Notice how His attention's on what's best for them. That You may not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. He went away again a second time, said the same thing again. "My Father, if possible, let this cup pass away." He says, if this cannot pass away unless I drink it, Your will be done. And again, He came and found them sleeping. And he left them again and went a third time, saying the same thing once more. Then he came to his disciples again. He said, "Are you still sleeping? Are you still sleeping? It's time. The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let's go. The betrayer is almost here." At that moment, Judas, one of the 12, came up to him. And he's accompanied by a large mob with swords and clubs sent from the Jewish leaders. And Jesus came up to him, Judas came up to him and greeted him with this double-faced hypocrisy. "Hail, Rabbi." And he kissed him. And at that moment, the mob seized him. And at first, his disciples began to fight, but Jesus commanded them, "Lay down your swords. The scriptures must be fulfilled." Notice how Jesus, even in all this chaos, is in total command and saying, the scriptures must be fulfilled. The scriptures say it must happen this way. And all of his disciples left him and fled, just as the scriptures said. Just as Jesus said. Jesus was led then to Caiaphas, the high priest, where many of the Jewish leaders were gathered together. False witnesses came forward. The leaders wanted evidence so that they could put him to death, but the false witnesses even contradicted one another. The high priest himself then called Jesus under oath to admit whether he claimed to be the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus quoted two crucial scriptures, Psalm 110 and Daniel 7, and merges them together. And he says, "You've already said, but I'll say it again, very soon you'll see the Son of Man coming, sitting at the right hand of God with power and coming on the clouds of heaven." And that, man, bringing Psalm 110 and Daniel 7 together and saying, "That's me," was just too much, or just enough, depending on how you look at it. The high priest tore his robes and he said, "He's blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? You've heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And they all cry out, "He deserves death." And they spit on his face. They beat him with their fists. Others slap him and mock him and say, prophesy to us. You're the Messiah. Who hit you?" Right? And you can just see them mocking and having so much sick fun over all this. In the morning, they bound him and they led him away and delivered him over to Pilate, the governor. And there they accused him of making himself out to be this king who would lead an insurrection and rebellion against Caesar. And so Pilate questions him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus just says, "That's what you hear. That's what you say. You say so." The Jewish leaders continued to hurl charges against him, but Jesus gives no answer. Pilate said, do you not hear all the charges they're bringing against you?" Jesus didn't answer a single charge. Pilate knew the Jewish leaders handed Jesus over because of envy. And Pilate's wife even sent a message to him, urging him to have nothing to do with this righteous man because she'd suffered a nightmare about him that night. And so Pilate brings out this notorious prisoner, Barabbas, before the crowd. It was his custom at Passover to release a prisoner. And so Pilate said, "Who do you want me to release for you? Barabbas? Or this Jesus who's called your king, who's called the Messiah?" The Jewish leaders are stirring up the crowds, right? Stirring up the crowds, ask him, "We want Barabbas, and we want Jesus put to death." Pilate said, "Well, what do I do with this one who's called the Messiah?" They all said, "Crucify him." And Pilate is shocked by this, seemingly shocked by their answer. What evil has he? Pilate knows how low crucifixion is. What evil has he done? They gave no answer. They just keep shouting all the more, "Crucify him, crucify him." And so Pilate very weakly washes his hands with water as a gesture for the people. And he says, I am innocent of this man's blood." And then in just this sad, evil ignorance, the people say, "His blood shall be on us and our children." They had no idea what they're saying. So Pilate had Barabbas released, but Pilate had Jesus scourged and then handed him over to be crucified. They stripped Jesus naked. They put a scarlet robe on him. They twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They put a reed in his right hand. They knelt down before him and mocked him, "Hail, King of the Jews." They spat on him, then they took the reed and started beating him on the head. And then when they finished their obscene, twisted mocking, they took that scarlet robe off, put his own clothes back on him, and led him away to be crucified. On the way to the execution site, the soldiers forced a man named Simon to carry his cross. Then they came to the execution site, a place called Golgotha, the place of the skull. And they gave him wine to drink mixed with gall, but he wouldn't drink it. And then they crucified him. I'm going to read Matthew 27. Verses 35 and following. And when they crucified him, they divided up his garments among themselves by casting lots. And sitting down, they began to keep watch over him. And above his head, they put up the charge against him, which read, "This is Jesus, the King of the Jews." At that time, two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left. And those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, come down from the cross." In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes and elders, were mocking him, saying, "He saved others. He cannot save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him now come down from the cross and we'll believe in him. He trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he delights in him. For he said, 'I'm the Son of God.'" The two robbers who'd been crucified with him were also insulting him with the same words. Now, from the sixth hour, darkness fell upon the whole land until the ninth hour. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani?" That is to say, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of those who were standing there when they heard it began saying, "This man's calling for Elijah." Immediately one of them ran, and taking a sponge, he filled it with sour wine and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. But the rest said, "Let us see whether Elijah will come and save him." And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. He died. And it's precisely for this reason, just as we said this morning, not incidental to, but precisely for this reason, that we're told God highly exalted him. The cross is where the holy and righteous one was disowned for a murderer. The cross is where the Prince of Life was put to death. The cross is where the powers of evil that have dominated this world have gathered in full force to wage war against the Son of God. Shame, injustice, violence, even sexual violence, and where those same powers were utterly defeated. The cross is where judgment is rendered upon this world, where the ruler of this world is cast out. The cross is where the Son of God rendered powerless him who had the power over death, that is the devil, and frees those who through fear of death were subject to its slavery all their lives. The cross is where he disarmed the rulers and authorities and made a public display of them, having triumphed over them. The cross is where he broke down the barrier of the dividing wall and abolished in his flesh the enmity, where he made both Jew and Gentile into one new humanity and established peace. The cross is where God hears our groanings and chooses to groan with us. Where the cries of the psalmist become the cries of God himself. My God, why have you forsaken me? The cross is where God himself entered into our experiences. The cross is where God himself meets us in our sin and weakness, our shame from all that we've done, and shame from all that's been done to us. The cross is where the nature of God is truly revealed, where the King of creation becomes like the child, right? Where the last becomes first and the least proved to be far and above the greatest. where the Son of Man did not come to serve, but to be served. Did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life a ransom for many. Where the righteousness and justice of God is revealed. Where the love of God is revealed and known. The cross is where we receive mercy. The cross is where we receive forgiveness. The cross is where we learn to give mercy, where we learn to forgive. The cross is where we know love and where we learn to love. Fleming Rutledge, in her masterful work on the crucifixion, she's got a chapter called The Godlessness of the Cross that's by far worth the price of the book. The crucifixion is the touchstone of Christian authenticity, the unique feature by which everything else, including the resurrection, is given its true significance. And that truth bears out all over the place throughout our scriptures. The very center of the gospel, as I said at the beginning, the very beating heart of the gospel is the proclamation, this story that I just told of a crucified king. And so that's where we come together today. We all come, as Jesus said on the night that he was betrayed, as he takes that Passover meal and repurposes it and reconstitutes it in and around, not now that salvation and judgment against Egypt, from Egypt, but now the judgment and salvation that he would have over sin and death and Satan. And he calls us together to eat and drink and to remember and share, to have fellowship with him in his death, in his life, to have fellowship with one another. And so regardless of where we are in our life, whatever struggles we have, our weaknesses, sins, as we come here together now to share in his grace, to share in his mercy, to share in his love, to be loved by him and known by him and to receive him. And so may our eating and drinking be to his glory and for our good.